Well, I want to thank the various sponsors of this talk today for having me. And what I'll do is I'm going to work through the talk and then hope and expect that you'll probably have some questions and comments at the conclusion of the talk. I'll be happy to take those then. Anyone who tuned in even to a few hours of the Alito or Roberts confirmation hearings, I think would have quickly realized that one single precedent from the U.S. Supreme Court has gained paramount importance in the judicial selection process. That decision, Roe versus Wade, has become a political and a legal hotcake, not just for the nominees, faced with questions both from pro-life and pro-choice senators, but also for the political parties. Democratic politicians expend remarkable amounts of political capital in a desperate and sometimes shrill effort to ensure that Supreme Court nominees protect the right to abortion, even while the Democratic Party has lost the presidency and the Congress, largely due to voters' concerns over its position on family values. Pro-choice groups similarly expend vast resources defending Roe in the court of public opinion. Clearly, we stand on a precipice, with the core holding of Roe teetering in the balance somewhere between the votes of three men, Justices Kennedy, Roberts, and perhaps Alito. How did we arrive at this place of political Armageddon? In 1973, the Supreme Court decided the landmark case of Roe versus Wade, as well as its companion case, Doe versus Bolton. In those cases, the Supreme Court struck down laws from Texas and Georgia that criminalized abortion except under very limited circumstances involving the mother's life, when that life was in danger. The impact of this decision would be far-reaching, but not necessarily in the ways that one might have anticipated at the time the cases were decided. In this talk, I will argue that while Roe versus Wade was born of good intentions, it offers a dramatic lesson also in the law of unintended consequences. Clearly, Roe versus Wade provided a constitutional right to abortion, which resulted in the immediate liberalization of abortion laws in many states, where obtaining or providing abortion was a criminal act in most circumstances. That was a laudable outcome. Since Roe was decided, however, we have witnessed a slow degradation of that right at the hands of the Supreme Court, with a divided court adopting progressively more lenient standards towards state laws restricting abortion rights, and with state legislatures quickly seizing upon the opportunity to enact further restrictions on the right. Over the same period, we also have witnessed a vociferous and sometimes violent backlash from fundamentalists and pro-life organizations that adamantly oppose Roe. In addition, Roe has contributed substantially to the dramatic polarization between right and left that we see in American politics today, and some argue to the increasing dominance of the Republican Party at all levels of government. While Roe may be celebrated at some level, it is also illuminated to conduct a form of cost-benefit analysis by considering both the costs and the benefits of Roe in its historical and political context. Let me begin by saying that I personally support a woman's right to reproductive freedom, including the right to make the often traumatic and difficult decision to abort a pregnancy. Roe versus Wade was commendable in that the Supreme Court pronounced that such a right finds its source in the U.S. Constitution. But in this presentation, I will also argue that because the Roe decision was never endorsed politically through legislative action, it has resulted in certain detrimental consequences in the larger political and legal arenas, both for women's rights and for American politics. In fact, I'm going to argue that in some respects, we may have been better off in the long run if Roe had not been decided. Given that it was decided, I'll offer some observations about what approaches we might now take to protect and possibly extend the rights of women to reproductive freedom in this country. First, let me address the content of Roe and its initial impact on abortion regulation throughout the American states. Roe held that a woman's right to choose to abort her pregnancy was protected by the constitutional right to privacy, but it also held that that right was not absolute. According to the court, the right could only be limited if the state had a compelling interest to do so. It further elaborated that the state could have no compelling interest in restricting a woman's right to abortion in the first trimester, but could have a compelling interest in the mother's health in the second trimester, and in the third trimester, the state could have a compelling interest in the life of the fetus following viability. Thus, the court created a sliding scale regarding the potential restrictions available to the states, of course permitting more stringent limitations as the pregnancy proceeded. In rendering this decision, the court effectively invalidated abortion restrictions in 46 states and in the District of Columbia. Following Roe, most states rewrote their abortion statutes, some continuing to restrict abortion to circumstances in which the mother's life was at stake, in direct and outright defiance of Roe. Some states rewrote their abortion statutes to conform carefully to the Roe standard. But a good number wrote statutes that were not in outright defiance of Roe, but which imposed a substantial number of obstacles to a woman's choice to have an abortion. Among those obstacles were parental and spousal notification and consent procedures, provisions, the banning of abortions in public hospitals, or the requirement that an abortion take place in a hospital. Informed written consent, which often included descriptions of the horrors of abortion. 24-hour waiting periods and requirements that the physician file a pathology report or dispose of the fetus in a particular fashion. Many of these restrictions were upheld by the court even under the Roe standards. In the 1990s, however, the legal landscape changed. In the face of continuing political and legal controversy over Roe, the court upheld the core holding of Roe, but eliminated the sliding scale based on trimesters that was established in the Roe opinion. Instead, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who I think of as the master of the ambiguous compromise, created the undue burden standard, allowing states to restrict abortions as long as those restrictions did not impose an undue burden on the constitutional right. This vague standard, as you might imagine, opened the floodgates for states to experiment with additional statutory restrictions, which limitations could only be determined constitutional or unconstitutional by the very court that created the ambiguous standard. The vague undue burden standard clearly shifted the balance of power to the court in terms of defining a woman's right to privacy, since who else could possibly know what it meant to impose a, quote, undue burden, unquote. Hence, I think in confirmation hearings, we now see an enhanced focus on nominees' positions regarding abortions, even at the expense of other compelling issues, such as, for example, executive power. At the same time that the legal landscape was changing, so too was the political landscape. It's important to note that prior to Roe, the trend in this country was to liberalize abortion rights. Indeed, evaluation of the empirical record suggests that in the late 60s and early 70s, a social revolution was underway that included increased tolerance for abortion. The largest yearly increases in the number of abortions obtained by women throughout the period occurred prior to Roe, not after the decision was rendered. Prior to Roe, a number of both state and federal courts had invalidated restrictions on abortions. Moreover, prior to Roe, no single law was proposed in Congress to limit federal funding of abortion. President Johnson's Advisory Council on the Status of Women recommended repeal of all anti-abortion statutes. Around the same time, and I think this will surprise you, the Department of Defense liberalized its abortion policies by permitting abortions in military hospitals. Nor was abortion an issue in the 1968 elections. In fact, Nixon essentially avoided the issue even after Roe. Likewise, President Ford barely mentioned abortion during his presidency. In fact, it was not until the Carter presidency, surprisingly enough, that we see the first presidential opposition to abortion. Happy Nova. Carter opposed federal funding for women receiving state-provided medical benefits to obtain abortions. Following Carter, of course, we then see substantial attention from Republican presidents to what they term the evils of abortion and to the purported constitutional invalidity of Roe versus Wade. At the congressional level, however, the response to Roe was swift and clear. Within 1 week of the court's decision in Roe, proposals to curtail abortions became numerous, many involving constitutional amendments to overturn Roe. By one count, some 68 constitutional amendments were proposed in the immediate wake of Roe alone, and more amendments were proposed in subsequent years. Other congressional efforts focused on banning federal funding of abortions, successfully culminating with the Hyde Amendment. Similarly, in state legislatures, a flurry of legislative bills were introduced following Roe. By one count, 260 proposals were introduced by the end of 1973 alone. Many of these proposed laws restricted rather than liberalized abortion rights. In some states, attorneys general or boards of medical examiners threatened to prosecute or remove the medical licenses of any doctor performing an abortion. And as I mentioned previously, in some states, the new statutes, as passed, simply continue to restrict abortion to limited circumstances, requiring further litigation to eliminate. At the same time, a veritable bumper crop of anti-choice interest groups emerged following Roe, including the American Life Lobby, Americans United for Life, the National Right to Life Committee, the Pro-Life Action League, and Operation Rescue, names I'm sure you're familiar with. These groups have adopted both peaceful lobbying techniques and more violent means to undermine women's right to abortion. In addition to simple harassment, which has become in many places constant and intolerable, the hostile actions, including bomb threats, blocking clinic doors, trespassing, vandalism, and other aggressive means. Concurrent with this rise in pro-life group, the feminist movement appeared to fizzle, no doubt in part due to the loss of one of its galvanizing issues. Roe eliminated one of the key elements of the movement's agenda. In short, losers are often more motivated in American politics than our winners, especially when the loss is experienced as a result of the actions of an unelected judiciary rather than through the democratic process. In addition to these events, many of which can be traced directly to Roe, the abortion issue has completely changed the American political landscape, in many ways causing a realignment of the political parties and substantially contributing to the current polarization in the electorate. It may surprise you to learn that at the time Roe was decided, Republican voters were more pro-choice than Democrats, and that trend continued for some time to come. At the elite level, particularly among congressmen and senators, a difference more quickly emerged between Republicans and Democrats, with Republicans coming to seize upon the so-called pro-life message. This shift in elite preferences at the congressional level was probably due to responses to party activists, tend to be more extreme, rather than in response to mass preferences. But in any event, the masses responded eventually to signals from the elites, with abortion becoming one of the defining issues differentiating the Republicans and the Democrats. This party realignment may be traced in large part to Roe, which created the motivation for anti-choice activism. Today, it continues to be perhaps the single most defining issue polarizing the electorate and the parties, as the recent Alito hearings clearly attest. The upshot of this massive reaction and resistance to Roe has been woeful for women's actual rights with regard to making their own reproductive choices are concerned. Here are the facts. In 2006, only one abortion provider exists in states like South Dakota and Mississippi. As Ellen Goodman pointed out in a recent editorial, the South Dakota clinic is open only one day a week. Moreover, the Democratic Party expends an inordinate amount of political capital to keep Roe on the books. Part of the problem involves the constitutional underpinnings of Roe, which renders it subject to attacks on grounds that it fails that it rests on no textual commitment in the Constitution. More fundamentally, however, abortion allows the Republicans to capitalize on voters' values even in the face of other policies that clearly undermine the interests of many Republican voters. In his book, What's the Matter with Kansas, Thomas Frank argues that until the 1990s, Kansas was a state governed by moderate Republicans. And even in 1990, the state elected a Democratic majority to the state Kansas State House. He points out, however, that the push that started Kansas hurtling down the crevice of reaction was provided by Operation Rescue, which initiated an anti-choice rally in Wichita in the summer of 1991. Unfortunately, in response to the planned rally, the city's clinics voluntarily closed up for a week when the protests began. For the anti-choice protesters, this was a miracle in the making. As Frank points out, for once, Operation Rescue had stopped what they called the abortion industry in its tracks. Yet, as Frank also effectively argues, these same voters vote for Republicans who otherwise endorse economic policies clearly at odds with the average Kansan's self-interest, repeal of the estate tax, reduction of social services, or tax cuts for the wealthy. Frank notes that what motivates many of these voters to vote for Republicans does not involve their own economic self-interest, but rather their stance on abortion. For a simple illustration of the ways in which abortion has altered Kansas politics, simply consider the difference between former Kansas Senator Bob Dole and current Kansas Senator Sam Brownback. Moreover, with Roe on the books, Republican politicians never have to put their money where their mouths are when it comes to criminalizing abortion. They can simply continue to spout anti-choice rhetoric all the while fully confident that Roe protects them from any accountability for that position. Indeed, some commentators have argued that should the Republicans actually be forced by their right-wing base to vote to criminalize abortion, it would cause a massive shift in suburban voting patterns. Where a moderate electorate currently pacified by a belief that Roe provides women with adequate legal protections would mobilize to swing elections to pro-choice Democrats. At the very worst, were the abortion issue to be cast into the legislative arena instead of the judicial one, we would probably end up with the kind of restrictions that are currently in place under the eviscerated Roe regime. Public opinion polls consistently show that more than 60% of Americans support access to abortion in some circumstances. At the very best, such an outcome could lead to Democratic majorities in state and federal governments, which would inevitably lead to expanded reproductive rights for women. But you demur. You argue in response to my points that without Roe, many women would die in back alleys, since states would pass restrictive laws, and women would be forced to look to criminals to terminate their pregnancies. My response is that in many states, women already have no choice. Poor women have even fewer options. Moreover, it was exactly the argument that women were forced into back alleys that created the Democratic trend prior to Roe to liberalize abortion rights. It is an unfortunate and very sad fact, but a true one, that often citizens must suffer before rights are granted in our democracy. And rarely are those rights effectively granted by courts, especially when they're acting alone. Witness the civil rights movement. Yes, Brown versus Board of Education pronounced that segregated education was unconstitutional, but Brown did not cause the desegregation of schools. Even 10 years after Brown, less than 5% of black children in the South attended integrated schools. It took Bloody Sunday, the deaths in Philadelphia, Mississippi, and other violent events publicized in the media to push Congress to pass the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the Elementary and Secondary Schools Act, which denied federal funding to segregated schools. It was only after legislative action, not court intervention, that we witnessed the actual realization of civil rights for black children in the South. The same is likely to be true of women with respect to abortion. Constitutional rights are wonderful, but they are meaningless if they are more often recognized in the breach. And unlike Brown, Roe has never been legitimated by congressional action. In conclusion, we often acclaim Roe as a landmark event in the course of the women's movement. I think it's time we saw Roe from a different perspective. Roe created a backlash against women's rights. It polarized American politics in ways that have disadvantaged Democrats, and it has not resulted in the widespread availability of abortion services in many parts of this country. Without Roe, we may have had a continuing trend at the state level to liberalize abortion rights. Without Roe, we might witness a reinvigoration of the women's movement, which could only benefit women more broadly. Without Roe, we might see more female voters coming to the polls to vote their rights. Without Roe, we would see Republican politicians no longer shielded by a weakened Supreme Court precedent, but actually forced to vote their right-wing agendas and be held accountable for them. Without Roe, we could see the Democratic Party, clearly the party more likely to protect women's reproductive freedoms at this point, appealing to voters' economic interests more effectively rather than losing many voters to the Republican Party over this very divisive issue of values. Of course, such conclusions beg the question. It seems politically infeasible for Democrats to simply give up on Roe. How could that even be done? By whispering in the liberal justices' ears to abandon Roe? Obviously, that's not a viable option. But shifting the focus from Roe and the courts to the legislative arena would ultimately be more productive. One option is to propose a Freedom of Choice Act in Congress that would hold Republicans accountable for their extreme positions on abortion. Such an act actually came close to passage in 1990. Another approach would be for the Democratic Party to welcome pro-life Democrats into the fold. While ultimately such a large tent would lead to more legislative compromises on abortion, it's likely that those compromises would be more palatable to pro-choice Democrats than any legislation proposed and passed by Republicans. In my mind, Roe poses a conundrum of massive proportions. But it also clearly behooves us, for women's sake, to think creatively and divergently about more effective and politically pragmatic solutions to this critical issue that so obviously implicates women's autonomy and their privacy. The place to begin is for pro-choice activists to abandon their rigid death grip on the icon of Roe versus Wade. It's time to realize that Roe is not the mythical Holy Grail. Instead, in many ways, it has provided a very real obstacle to the realization through the democratic process of full reproductive rights for women. Thank you.